Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in the closing days before a watershed election with Kevin O'Leary, a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and a former reporter for Time magazine and the Los Angeles Times, whose forthcoming book is Reactionary Revolution, the GOP's Attack on the Founders and the American Idea. He joins us to discuss the frantic last-minute racist demagoguery and fear-mongering spewing from Trump at rallies in states where Republicans hope to hold on to their slim majority in the Senate, and whether Trump's lack of focus on the House means that flipping more than enough Republican House seats in California and across the country is increasingly likely. Then we will examine how economic factors rather than racial resentment played a larger role in Trump's 2016 election, based on a new study at INET, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. A co-author of the report, Thomas Ferguson, joins us. He is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, and we will discuss how, after taking credit for the economic recovery that Obama brought about, Trump is now doubling down on racial resentment, both in terms of immigrant bashing and casting China, the Democrats, globalists, and the press as the enemy. Then finally, in the closing days before a watershed election, we'll get an analysis of whether the majority in this country will show up at the polls in sufficient numbers to overcome the vote rigging by the minority. Ian Samuel, a professor of law at Indiana University, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Rigging the Vote, How the American Right is on the Way to Permanent Minority Rule, and what strategies can be employed to reverse the formidable project of the Republican right to install permanent minority rule to guarantee control of the government, even though fewer and fewer Americans support their policies and programs. This growing tyranny of the minority should be clear, since the last two Republican presidents entered office with fewer votes than their opponents got, and the last two justices to join the Supreme Court were confirmed with lifetime appointments to the court by senators who received 22 million fewer votes than the senators who voted against him in the case of Gorsuch. And in the case of Kavanaugh, he was confirmed by senators who received 38 million fewer votes than the senators who voted no. So the challenge is not just to win on Tuesday, but to wrestle back control of the entrenched minority from the entrenched minority with an overwhelming victory, then begin the work of leveling the playing field. And joining us now is Kevin O'Leary, a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, who's formerly a reporter for Time magazine and the Los Angeles Times. His forthcoming book is Reactionary Revolution, the GOP's Attack on the Founders and the American Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin O'Leary.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And just to touch on what our third guest is going to be talking about, the imbalance, if you will, the tyranny of the minority, and the extent to which the Republicans are trying to entrench this permanent majority through their control of the Supreme Court and control of the Senate, which in effect means they can control the courts. My understanding is that just to break even in this election, the Democrats have to get about 7 to 8% more votes than the Republicans. This is due to gerrymandering and, of course, the slave states' electoral college. So that's if you factor that in, where do you think the Democrats stand at this point a couple of days before the election?
Well, you know, it's hard. I guess, number one, this is a tough election to figure out post-2016 because the polling didn't work as accurately as people thought it was in 2016. So you've got some maybe hidden Trump supporters. It's just like, do the polls capture what's going on or do things change? But you're right. There is a problem for the Democrats just even before the vote suppression efforts, which are really, you know, just out there and baldly being done in Georgia, for example, that the way politics is set up right now, the red states, the rural states, there's just a bias against the population centers in the country, just the way the math works and how political representation works. So there is a bias. So Democrats usually get more votes in these elections but get less representation. And then you add on the voter suppression, which in a very real way is my thoughts on this election and where the Republicans have moved. They've moved from a conservative party. They left conservatism, you know, and moved to a reactionary stance. And they are very much like the Southern politics model of the old South, in the sense of just playing the demagogue card that Trump does very effectively, and of the voter suppression just being out there doing whatever they can to push down the vote. I mean, classically, when they, after Reconstruction, and then in the early 1900s, when Jim Crow came in after the populist rebellion, the white bourbon class, as it was called in the South, the plantation class, they cracked down not just on blacks, but on poor whites in the South. And they were trying to get rid of both of them because they were afraid of both. And they've come back now, and they're using those techniques against anybody they think that's going to vote on the Democratic ticket across as many states as they can. So the Democrats have to turn out with enthusiasm. And the dilemma this time that's hard to call is, and you can interject in it whenever you want, but if I look back to 2006, I was covering the congressional races for Politics and Elections. And the Democrats, you know, George W. Bush is in trouble because of the Iraq War and Katrina, and the Democrats had all the energy in that election. And then in 2010, somehow with the Tea Party and the economy just being so bad and Obama getting blamed for it, the Tea Party has been able to have that, you know, incredible run of capturing over 60 House seats. And this time, the Democrats have had this the resistance going and a lot of energy. That's great, but you know, the Republicans are still there, and the fact that Trump has, you know, 46% support in the country is, you know, a number that he had before, and it's not a good sign. So we really have to turn out.
So what about the possibility of blowback from the general concerns which should be manifest that this president is unfit for office and is a dangerous sociopath?
When we talk about the Republicans, you know, just as a reporter, I think we need to move past calling them conservatives. I mean, the LA Times called the Georgia candidate for governor, Brian Kemp, a brash conservative. That's not what he is, right? And the blowback, when we talk about the base, that instantly conjures up the working class vote that Trump was able to get in the northern industrial states and his base in the South among the working class. But it's really the whole Republican Party, which a lot, when you look at the analysis of 2016, his voters were above the medium income. It was middle class and upper middle class white voters who were the business class. And I think that is the key. Is there enough of a blowback? Is there enough of a step back from some of those people who have voted for Reagan and they know that Trump is not like Reagan at all? And some of them are stepping back. I've heard anecdotal things, and we all have, of people that voted Republican before and are not going to do it, not just among white women in the suburbs, but white men who are Republicans. And I think the key to this election and the next is if the Democrats, and just don't know why it's not resonating, are able to say this is a real threat to the foundations of the country. And the problem is you've got people on the right who've always voted on the right. They're always with the business class. And they say, you know, if they're cutting my taxes, that's all I care about. That's all I care about. And they won't open their eyes to the threat. And at the same time, the right, the media, has done this game, and I just saw it in the Orange County Register today, of saying what's going on the right and then trying to blame the left. And it's like they do that all the time with Fox News. So it's a tough situation. It's like you'd think from what we're watching, that there would be less support on the Republican side, that it would have eroded somewhat, that his support would be 35 or 40, but he's at 46, and I don't know.
And again, I'm speaking with Kevin O'Leary. He's a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time magazine and the Los Angeles Times. His forthcoming book is Reactionary Revolution, the GOP's Attack on the Founders and the American Idea. So, but for example, here in the state of California, I think you've got 14 Republican seats up for grabs. 11 of those Republicans voted for this outrageous tax break for the super rich, which they sold as a middle class tax cut. And most recently, Trump is, as he throws anything at the wall, hoping that anything will stick, along with fear mongering and immigrant bashing. He said that we're going to push through a middle class tax cut before the election, even though the House was not in session. That obviously is a de facto recognition that that the so-called middle-class tax cut was not real, and people figure that one out. So there's some sense that maybe people are starting to figure out that they're being had. And what's your reading on the extent to which the state of California could go a long way to flipping the House? It does seem like Trump is focusing on the Senate. His rallies are in states where there's a possibility of Republicans picking up Senate seats. He seems to have given up on the House.
Right. I think one way to think about what Trump is doing now, and this is, I had dinner with some friends last night, and one of them mentioned that Trump's trying to build a wall around the Senate. That's his defense against Mueller and everything, and so he's using the immigration, and the whole thing is it's a caravan. I mean, how'd they come up with this phrase? And the fact that it gets repeated, it's poor mothers and kids walking north. So he's using that, right? In California, I think a lot of the GOP seats are vulnerable. They're close elections. This is the first time in Orange County, for example, where we've had serious Democratic challengers that have raised equal or more money. In the fact of, say, Katie Porter in the 45th district, than her opponent. And the fact for Republican voters, I think it was a mistake. Mimi Walters is the incumbent in that race, that she voted with Trump on the tax cut, and that, importantly, took away the property tax deduction for homeowners, and at least in a significant way. And I think Porter's has had the support of the realtors in her election. And I think that could make a difference in some of these very close House races. So I think the Democrats will pick up a number of the California seats, not all of them, because some of them are so entrenched red, but some.
Yeah, well, that vote was such a petty Republican punitive measure against successful blue states like California. Mm-hmm. It was just so naked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's certainly it's getting the attention of wealthier Californians who are really getting hit with massive tax bills, which they used to be able to deduct. But you mentioned the Mueller investigation. I think one way or the other, I don't think the Mueller inquiry is going to be with us much longer. I think if Trump loses the House, he will quickly find a way to get rid of Rosenstein and shut down Mueller. And if he wins the House, then and the Senate, then he'd be emboldened and be able to even do it with more alacrity. So that's my sense, is that this is what's so frustrating. This is a man who's been one step ahead of the sheriff in his entire professional life. He is so mobbed up. He is so much owned by Putin and the Russian intelligence. And he was, essentially seduced by Russian mob money, he's been controlled by the Kremlin since about 1987. And the whole story is yet to come out. The intelligence people know about it, but for the life of me, I don't understand why they can't get this story out. Because the problem with most Americans can't get their head around the idea that their president is not just a criminal but a traitor. And the case is there, but it's not yet made, and it's very frustrating.
Yeah, and the fact that there's some people like, Sully Sullenberg came on MSNBC last night. He was on the O'Donnell show, and he came out and just said,
he's the guy that the hero that landed the plane, and that Tom Hanks played him in a movie.
Yes, yes, the hero that incredibly landed the plane and saved all those lives on the Hudson River. And he said, "Look, my father and I, we were both in the military, and he's just appalled at Trump's behavior." And he said one thing that was really clear. He said, "Leaders are not supposed to be about themselves," and that is just so plain with President Trump. And whether more people who are voting on the Republican side can eventually see that this guy is just out for himself, that's going to make a big difference over the next 2 years.
Well, it's not that he's out for himself. That's been clear from day one. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, the state of panic that he's in is clearly because he sees the law closing in on him with the Mueller inquiry, and with the possibility, if the Democrats take the House, then they'll have subpoena power, and then people like Devin Nunes won't be protecting him anymore.
Right, right, right.
So you're pretty confident that the Dems will take the House, which
I'm cautiously optimistic. I just think that these races, there's been enough in play. Like, so many races are in play, and for example, there's that Kansas seat that you wouldn't think in Kansas that a Democrat would have a chance. And the person's quite liberal. She's got an Army background. I think she's lesbian, and she's doing fine. And there's a Colorado seat. The Colorado districts outside of Denver, on either east or west, they kind of flip back and forth from the Democrats to the Republicans. And one of those is the Democrat running, is the challenger's doing well.
That's Jason Crow, right?
Yeah. So I think there's enough places where we're in ahead, and if the turnout, if they can get the GOTV to work, and I don't think the messaging, in terms of the news hasn't gone against the Democrats in the last week. If anything, the tragic synagogue shooting muddled Trump's message and slowed his momentum about just talking about the caravan, and he was hoping that the images of people walking north would be all over the media, and that didn't happen. And he's got this, the fact that there's a straight line between the shooter saying basically he listened to the president's message and didn't think the president was doing enough, and that he had to step in, and that synagogue was part of an effort, an old organization that had been around forever, of helping asylum seekers and migrants. It wasn't just that they were Jewish, it was that they were doing this as well. And so that, that's confronting his message. So the Dems are lucky this time that they're lucky basically in the sense that Trump hasn't doubled down, tripled down on the economy. In the aftermath of this, if the Democrats do well, people on the Republican side are going to look back and say, why didn't you talk about the economy? Why didn't you just take credit for that? And, he knows the base. He knows this amps up people, and he thinks the business class is going to vote for him anyway. So he's trying to get the people that will get excited about immigration to go out and turn it into the old days in California with the Prop 187.
Right. Well, just in closing, though, I guess the message is that things look good for the Democrats on the House side, not necessarily so on the Senate side. There's still a chance, I believe, something like one in seven chances.
I don't think we're going to take the Senate, but like McCaskill, she's had a history of really close races and being able to pull them out in Missouri. So we'll see if she can do it again. The governor in Tennessee, running for Senate, was a terrific governor. He's more of a centrist, but was really well thought of in that state. He might be able to squeak through. Mm-hmm. You might get the Senate seat in Florida. To get enough to get control, because so many seats that are up are on the Democratic side. Just the math, the way the map was laid out, was not favoring us.
Sure.
So it's a tough year.
Well, Kevin O'Leary, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot, Ian. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Kevin O'Leary, who's a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of California, Irvine, and formerly a reporter for Time Magazine and the Los Angeles Times. And his forthcoming book is Reactionary Revolution, the GOP's Attack on the Founders and the American Idea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Trump is doubling down on racial resentment, both in terms of immigrant bashing and casting China, the Democrats, globalists, and the press as the enemy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and the co-author of a new report from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi, Ian. How you doing?
Well, not too bad. And, of course, there's a lot of anxiety now a couple of days before the elections and a lot of efforts to get the vote out. But I just was looking at some Republican GOP commercials that are running now saying that we don't want to go back to the Obama time. We don't want to stop this amazing recovery of the economy, and the implication being that somehow Obama ruined the economy and Trump rescued the economy. But the reality is that Obama inherited a free-falling economy, which fell apart on George W. Bush's watch. So is this to say, Tom, that you just simply can't expect truth and reality in politics anymore? I mean,
careful. My first response, would be anymore. My first question, because I am always impressed by the sort of funhouse character of all political ads, just about ever. Though I would agree that 30 years ago, the tenor of the distortions were different. But specifically on the economy, I actually have some trouble with everybody's positions on this, because I think you and I have been talking. We were talking at the time of the crash, and we all thought that Obama's response was half-size from what it was, and it was much better than Europe's. And in that respect, he certainly did make the United States economic situation a good deal better. You only have to go over to Europe to see how it's never recovered from 2008's problems. But on the other hand, it was only half the size of the stimulus they should have done, and it left out a lot of people. That's why we have Trump. That's basically the message of the paper that Ben Page and I and our other co-authors just put out of iNet, that, we are finally able to track down, if you like, the economic roots of Trumpism, too. We don't disagree that there's plenty of racial resentment and misogyny sitting around in those votes. But there's also a very clear economic distress signs that were going there. And in that respect, we have taxed all this stuff that's appearing by people claiming they can't find any economic, if you like, influences on the vote in 2016. That's plain wrong, and there's not much you can say it. Now, specifically on the question of the recovery, Obama obviously has to be given credit for leaving the economy a bit better back than it was in 2008. I'm thinking of the pitches in 2015 and 16 where they were saying, well, we're all the way back. Now, everybody wasn't all the way back. That's one problem by itself. The other side of it, though, is that the Democratic mainstream economists have had a view of what the economy could do, technically its potential output, that has been too pessimistic for a long time. And, within a week or two after the election, the mainstream Democratic economists were saying that it was time for the Fed to raise rates. Janet Yellen and other people at the Fed were a bit more skeptical, and to their credit, they were slow doing it. But the truth is that the Trump people had a better view of what was going on there. I think they were correct when they said they had people on the sidelines and did not have to raise rates at that point. I mean, the argument being that if you run out of people, then you just get pure inflation and wages. We still haven't hit that point, though. Finally, we are hitting a bit, not a lot, of wage growth. I mean, that's another point. The Trump people tend to oversell their recovery. What they've been doing is effectively putting more people to work at the same wage rates. Now, the very last numbers made that look a little better, but, let's let's see, one swallow doesn't make a summer. And in that respect, I'd say the conventional discussion of the U.S. economy has underrated the number of people on the sidelines. They're still on the sidelines, even prime age males, and I'm not picking on them for any other reason that that's your classic example you use for whether there's slack in the economy. That level of employment there is still not back to where it was before 2008 in terms of participation in the workforce. And you can say, well, yeah, some of these people are on drugs, et cetera. Yes, exactly. But, of course, a good deal of that drug response, I think, is clearly problems with despair over long-term unemployment. And in that respect, the U.S. is still, I think, hung over from 2008. And I don't like the Trump tax cuts were ridiculous. They're loaded to higher income. But in the short run, it did provide a big stimulus, and it was a stimulus that the Democrats ought to admit most of the mainstream folks, I mean, there were a bunch of us who weren't mainstream saying, no, there's a lot of slack in the economy. That position was clearly right. All the claims that, you know, right after the election, within 2 weeks, lots of Democratic economists were calling for, say it was time for the Fed to raise, they were wrong. That's one thing I think we've learned from the last 2 years, which is a pretty interesting thing to learn. And I think we will all be sort of unpacking this for quite some time in the next few years. I mean, essentially the mainstream view of potential output has been too pessimistic. It tends to just trail whatever output is, and then, with a little lag. And they need an independent assessment of that, to put it somewhat technically.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. And he's the co-author of a new report from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. So you've made the point that the birth of Donald Trumpism or Trumpism was in the 2008 crash, and that the analysis has largely been wrong, suggesting that it's all about racial resentment and dog whistle politics. Economic factors played a much, much larger role than previously acknowledged. But at this point, Tom, there's no question that Trump is doubling down on racial dog whistles and fear-mongering.
Yeah, he's doubling down on everything, including the economy, as you were observing right as you led into this, because essentially they're playing every theme in the book. And, you know, look, just to be clear, they were doing plenty of race baiting. They were doing some stuff that I'd call tacit closet anti-Semitism in some of those ads. Folks were playing just about everything. The full orchestra was playing in 2016. And for sure, race and misogyny were part of those appeals. They were part then, they're part now. On the other hand, you know, there are the economic appeals are also real. That's sort of the point in our paper, because huge numbers of folks have been saying they couldn't find any economic basis for the voting at all. I mean, there are books appearing even as I speak that, you know, make that claim. I don't think that's correct.
So how then, if Trump was able to get elected in 2016 by exploiting economic anxiety, now he's turning around and taking credit for a booming economy and saying it's the best it's ever been and he's the best president we've ever had. So how can that work then? If you, in 2016, you say you've been screwed by globalists and et cetera and by the Democrats, but now I've delivered you a booming economy, so you can't have it both ways.
Well, actually, right, the only question is going to be, is it really booming? And, you know, there it's a mixed case. I mean, except for the last numbers, which suggested some real wage growth, what you've been doing is putting more and more people back to work at either the same wages or indeed sometimes slightly lower. But employment was rising. No question about that. And for a lot of people on the periphery, not in places, in other words, where the economy has been booming, that's for real. That's a change that they notice. Now, You know, we're in a kind of gray zone here. Let's see what happens. And, you know, the right question to ask is what will be happening in 2020, I think. And, you know, that's basically if he's got wage growth going up still, then I think this guy's going to be a formidable candidate for reelection. I have never taken the view that Trump's or his campaigns were foolish. I never thought that. And I think they do stuff in a pretty calculated way. I regret a lot of what they do, but they do it. And so, you know, you can have it both ways in the sense that you can say, I've taken an economy. Let's see what happens. You know, I mean, the economic situation of a lot of Americans has somewhat improved. Now, we also know that, like, the tax cuts for a lot of lower income and the average people are going to sunset very fast. And, you know, there's the great bulk of the tax cut was loaded to upper income people. All of this is true. The question's going to be what's happening in the economy. You know, there's a view that somehow this can't be anything but smoke and mirrors. It is smoke and mirrors in the sense it's front loaded, it's rushed through. But you know, there's no question that employment has been going up. And not necessarily at higher wages. Only in the last numbers was there any suggestion of that. By last, I mean only a few days ago. But for folks who've seen no hiring in their town for a long time, which I think it does hit a lot of rural and semi-rural America as well as small towns, that's going to play. You know, I'll just have to see what happens here.
Well, but he's definitely done well for the wealthy. We know that. And that the middle-class tax cuts that he promised actually went to the super-rich and a few multinational corporations. And recently, talking about promising a middle-class tax cut before the election, even though the House was not in session, was so absurd. But it was a de facto recognition that the original tax cuts for the fraudulent tax cuts for the middle class, which were for the super rich, weren't working for him. So that much is clear, but we know that the deficit's being blown out. We'll have $1 trillion deficits for the next 4 years.
Janet Yellen agrees that is not looking good, and that's going to cause trouble.
Janet Yellen just said the other day that they're unsustainable. So again, you know, when you talk about front-loading, it's pretty cynical, isn't it, to have an artificial boost so that you get reelected or you hold on to the House and Senate. But the long-term damage is pretty profound.
It's totally cynical. It's not, I wouldn't regard it all as long-term damage, but I certainly think deficits of the size they're talking about are going to be a problem. And I'm assuming that they don't slide back into recession when I say that. There's one other issue here that is unpopular to mention, but I think it probably merits, which is Trump is also delivering some tariffs. Now, look, the tariff question is enormously controversial, but our research left no doubt at all that a lot of people were, if you were looking to explain blue-collar white support of Trump, tariffs was something that a lot of people liked. In there, it definitely distinguished Trump in the Republican primary in 2016, and it helped him in the general election too. And I'm not trying to tell you that tariffs are wonderful. I'm simply saying they're popular. Now, my own take on the tariff discussion is hugely complicated because, you know, it's obvious that if you have a world at full employment and investment is everywhere as high as you want it, as you think it should be, then free trade's got to be the best policy. You want folks. At the same time, we're very far from that in this world. And so, you know, in that type of situation, it's not so obvious that trade diversion doesn't sometimes make jobs. That's a relatively point of view that, you know, multinationals that move everywhere think that's just terrible. But, you know, it may, in fact, be true. I do think that the existing trade theories don't work very well out what happens in situations where everybody is below the level of full employment, though the U.S. is beginning to approach that. It's not there yet. You know, as I said, even prime age males you know, 26, 34, and they're still not in the labor force to the extent they were.
Right. But don't you think that
2008? So this is a mess. I mean, it's a very strange environment. And so,
but don't
I
you
mean,
think that Tom, there's an element of racist nationalism in these
that's the whole
idea. He's basically saying, you know, it's the Chinese that are screwing us, and we got to America first, and that the Democrats are in favor of globalism and I'm in favor of nationalism, and look at all those people coming up from Central America that are going to take your jobs away.
Yep.
I mean, there's
no
question.
That's absolutely clear. We found that in our paper. We actually say there's even an interaction between the demand for import relief and being white. We have evidence of that. I'm not disagreeing with you. That's clearly the case.
Well, what can be done?
That
though,
said, there's still a question about what do you do about trade policy.
Yep. Right, but in the 2 days before the vote, I don't think the Democrats have been able to counter Trump's dog whistles in terms of, you know, the brown people are coming to invade us, and the yellow people are stealing us blind. That's basically his message.
Well, it's part of his pitch, along with look what I'm doing for you in the economy. But now, yeah, I mean, I actually think it's an absolutely perfect piece of political theater to sort of focus on that caravan business, because it does highlight a weakness in the Democrats. You know, they don't have any clear policy that I can find to sort of deal with that, except to say, well, we have border controls. Well, yes, but, you know, and you got folks in there saying we should just abolish the border. Folks, I think they clearly need a radical restructuring. Not much doubt about that. But the truth is, the Democrats have a problem here in terms of the bulk of the population does not want to see sort of anything like open borders. And you can't get a clear statement out of Schumer, Pelosi, or anybody else on this question. And I think they're going to have to deal with this at some point.
Well, Thomas Ferguson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Thanks. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and co-author of a new report from the Institute for New Economic Thinking, The Economic and Social Roots of Populist Rebellion, Support for Donald Trump in 2016. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Republicans are rigging the vote and how the American right is on the way to permanent minority rule. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ian Samuel, a professor of law at Indiana University's Bloomington's Morris School of Law, where he teaches courses on cybersecurity and the federal courts. He is the co-host of First Monday's FM podcast and has an article at The Guardian, Rigging the Vote, How the American Right is on the Way to Permanent Minority Rule. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Samuel.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ian. And my understanding is that Democrats have to win 8% more votes just to break even. That's the current landscape from gerrymandering and the Electoral College. So that is so it's an uphill climb before you even begin. What's your sense of whether or not? Because the real challenge here is you can't just win. You've got to win big to wrestle back control from the entrenched minority with an overwhelming victory. And then, of course, you have to then begin the work of leveling the playing field. So a pretty daunting task.
It is a very daunting task. And when anybody who's listening to this, I hope they don't feel discouraged by the size of the challenge. You know, to the contrary, it is necessary to achieve an overwhelming victory because of the various interlocking institutions in American life that have been designed by the American right to ensure minority control of government. That is, the ability to control the government, even when most of the actual people in the country don't vote for them or would not vote for them if they could and don't approve of their policies. So it doesn't mean that victory is impossible, but, you know, you need to think about it, you know, almost from the perspective of a union organizer going into a contested election, you know, hoping for 51%. That's not enough. To really beat these people, you know, you need to be thinking along the lines of convincing overwhelming majorities. And then, yes, I agree, it's an incredibly urgent task to start leveling the playing field because that's not a healthy system.
So it should, the growing tyranny of the minority should be clear since the last two Republican presidents entered office with fewer votes than their opponents got, and the last two justices to join the Supreme Court were confirmed with lifetime appointments to the court by senators who received 22 million fewer votes than the senators who voted against him, and that's the case of Gorsuch. And in the case of Kavanaugh, he was confirmed by senators who received 38 million fewer votes than the senators who voted no. So that's just one of the points in your article at The Guardian, Ian Samuel, rigging the vote, how the American right is on the way to permanent minority rule. But that leads me to question whether or not the scale should come off our eyes about the Supreme Court and whether these gentlemen in robes, these five extremely conservative right-wing Catholics, are in fact basically political operatives, and particularly in the case of John Roberts. I mean, he's the architect of getting rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. That's obviously what's at play down in Georgia as we speak.
Yes, absolutely. And I do think, I'm glad you brought that up, because I do think it, when we see clearly that the Supreme Court has been, you know, look, there are four justices of that five-justice majority who were appointed by presidents who entered office having received fewer votes than their opponent in a national election. And that is really, that should be really striking. And so I think that one of the things that I've been talking about, that I've been encouraged to hear people at least, you know, willing to think about, is the next time the Democratic Party is in power, I think it needs to look at adjusting the size of the Supreme Court by adding some justices to account for the fact that, you know, this five-justice majority is not exactly what you would call democratically legitimate or in any way kind of bulletproof from a legitimacy perspective. So I think that that should be done. But of course, you know, first you've got to win control of Congress, which is itself hard. But I mean, removing Supreme Court justices is nearly impossible. And so the alternative, of course, is to add them.
But the advantage that the Republicans have via the Electoral College is that going forward, there are estimates now that by the year 2040, 70 U.S. senators will come from red states and only 30 from blue states because of the demographic shifts into blue states. And we learned from the last election that even though Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes in the popular vote, it didn't count. So that situation is just going to get worse, is it not, unless there's some radical changes. I mean, some of them would, I guess, the very least, if the Democrats got control of the House and Senate, And I suppose the White House, too, they could then make Puerto Rico and a state and Washington, D.C. a state. They'd pick up four more senators. But structurally, that has to be dealt with, doesn't it? The undemocratic nature of the Electoral College?
Absolutely, it does. And it is a challenging problem because the Electoral College will always systemically favor smaller, less populated states. And so the sort of Republican Party's entire orientation at the moment is to get the most number of votes in those small sort of rural, you know, typically, although not exclusively, much whiter states. And that is a serious problem to be dealt with because unlike some of these problems could be dealt with by legislation, right? So you could pass an act in Congress that would do a lot to fix gerrymandering. You could actually, you know, just an ordinary piece of legislation could expand the size of the Supreme Court so that we could be sure that, you know, these kinds of pro-democracy measures wouldn't be invalidated. The Electoral College is a trickier problem because under sort of conventional ways of thinking about it, you would need a constitutional amendment. Now, that can be done, but that's hard. There are some sort of unconventional approaches to solving it. But yes, I agree. it's getting more and more urgent. I mean, when Al Gore won by 500,000 votes and still lost the election, you could sort of say, well, that was so close, it almost counts as a tie or a rounding error. But, you know, Hillary Clinton winning by 3 million, and then, you know, of course, the Senate is even more hideously malapportioned. Democrats received 11 million more votes in the 2016 Senate campaign and didn't even win a majority of the seats that were up for election, which is really something. And these are problems baked in all the way at the level of constitutional design. And I think it's going to, you know, sooner or later, they have to be faced up to. And I think we're getting there.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Samuel, who's a professor of law at Indiana University Bloomington Morris School of Law, where he teaches courses on cybersecurity and the federal courts. And he's the co-host of First Monday's FM podcast and has an article at The Guardian, Rigging the Vote, How the American Right is on the Way to Permanent Minority Rule. And back to the Supreme Court, the extent to which it's now stacked to the right. There was a ruling recently on the constitutionality of efforts to get rid of gerrymandering mm-hmm. based upon what happened out here in California, which has turned out to be very successful. That came within one vote. So now you've got Kavanaugh on. The Supreme Court could actually strike down the very solution that you pointed to, which is a legislative fix for gerrymandering.
Yes, that's a problem, right? So a couple of years ago, the constitutionality of these, you know, so-called independent redistricting commissions, which are, you know, sort of neutral bodies that are outside the state legislature that are supposed to draw maps without respect to political advantage. And many states have these. And the question that got before the Supreme Court was not do you have to have those, but can you even have them? Does the Constitution actually prohibit independent redistricting commissions? And it was a 5-4 decision saying you can, but Kennedy was the one who used the swing vote. He's gone now. Justice Kavanaugh, you know, I don't know what his view is about this, but, you know, you have to at least strongly suspect that the case would have come out the other way and might come out the other way the next time it gets up there on an issue like this. And that's why, the Supreme Court is really essential, because it's true that they, you know, would be a useful tool for combating partisan gerrymandering if the courts were in the right hands, right? We almost did that this most recent term, then Justice Kennedy kind of decided he didn't want to. But we also need to understand that it's not just that they're not going to be helping. They might be hurting the project, and that has to be taken really seriously. And I think anybody with a kind of pro-democracy, pro-majority rule agenda, they have to be thinking about the courts and what you're going to do about that problem, because, you know, unless you're just going to get up there and all your sort of legislative efforts just get struck down and say, oh, well, I mean, we have to have a better answer than that.
Well, apparently in this election, which, of course, every election now records are broken in terms of money pouring in. And that's a result of Citizens United. Again, that was Kennedy's vote that mm-hmm. put that into law. You could maybe excuse him that he was a little naive. He thought that there would be a disclosure and that that would have a regulating effect. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that never happened. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is now we're learning that over 40% of the money pouring into this election, this midterm election on Tuesday, is dark money, largely from invisible plutocrats.
Yes. Yeah, and Citizens United is a great example of how the court can be part of the problem, right? So, campaign finance reform legislation was and remains extremely popular, even with people who identify as Republicans. And so, you know, in 2002, we had the McCain-Feingold bill, sponsored by John McCain and Russ Feingold, obviously of opposite parties. And so you might think, well, that's good, right? That means that we're having legislation address the problem. But the Supreme Court says, well, no, basically, you know, major portions of the law are unconstitutional and inoperative. And so that's an example of how it's not just that they're not helping. They're actually hurting, and they're kind of getting in the way of even when you do have some political power, of actually doing anything about this problem. And so they have to be kind of taken on those terms. And, you need some kind of serious solution to their involvement and their sort of obstruction of any kind of pro-democracy agenda.
Well, how about a narrative? I mean, surely you can make the narrative on behalf of the Democrats, which their leadership's not making, but there's obviously an awful amount of enthusiasm and energy at the grassroots. And again, you know, 8% more have got to show up just to break even. I don't think there's any shortage of energy and idealism and motivation. with the Democratic base. And you can tell from the money raising that even though 40% of the money pouring into this election is dark money coming from plutocrats, which is obviously going to fund the Republicans, small donors are funding all kinds of races across the country. So that's encouraging for the future, that the Democratic Party doesn't have to be hobbled by the fact that they get their same money as the Republicans do from big donors, but they get their votes from people who are getting screwed by the donors. You know, the Republicans have a natural advantage because they get money from donors with whom they have an ideological and political compatibility. So that's my sense, is that we're not going to get change in this country unless there's change within the Democratic Party itself, that the old guard, basically, which is pretty sclerotic, essentially goes off into the sunset. And we reinvent the party. In other words, if a bunch of rabid reactionaries calling themselves the Tea Party can take over the Republican Party, I don't see why young progressives can't take over the Democratic Party.
I think that's entirely correct, and that to me is the best vision of a way forward. You know, in other words, something like what sort of happened to the Labour Party in the United Kingdom fairly recently, which is that the base of the party, its membership base, really got control of the organization and said, you know, we're going to run this differently, and we're going to have really different leadership. It's based on different principles, and so I think but it's hard because to wean yourself from corporate money and to wean yourself from doing these, $2,000 a plate fundraisers and instead to rely on a broad base of popular support, I mean, that's hard because that means that that also has to imply changes in ideology because you now need to be appealing to a broad base of people and not just to a sort of, set of very, rich and sort of elite, class of people. So I think that's entirely right. And it is the only way forward. I mean, this is the hard part about it just replicates the classic struggle that always exists between capital and labor. The advantage capital has is they own everything, right? They have money. That's wonderful. And the advantage labor always has is that they have many, 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 many more people. And so you have to lean into that advantage and not say, well, we're going to try to fund ourselves with a different set of billionaires. You know, that's just not a coherent way forward, especially when you need, recall, as you say, you need to win by 8 points just to break even. So you really need to start to be thinking about, mass popular mobilizations. And that just doesn't work if the sort of authors of your policy agenda are the very people that are making the lives of normal working people worse in the first place.
But how about the notion, and I think it's pretty clear, it's a fact, in fact, that the Democratic Party stands for democracy and the Republican Party is anti-democratic and heading towards plutocracy and autocracy.
Well, yeah, I think that's clearly correct. I mean, I think it's revealed itself in the attitudes of the various parties about access to the franchise and things like that. I don't think it's an accident that every measure that makes it harder to vote is championed by Republicans and not Democrats and vice versa. So I think the Democrats actually need to start getting, really leaning into that even more and saying things like, for example, this is also something I've written about a little bit before, but there's nothing stopping, for example, the state of California or the state of New York or any place else from passing a law that says everyone in this state who is over the age of 16 and a resident of this state may vote in state and federal elections. States get to set the qualifications of their electors. So you could expand the franchise quite radically in states where you have control of the government, because I don't think it's just enough to sort of try to stand in the way and, try to stop, voter suppression. You need to be thinking about voter expansion. And that means, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that only citizens can vote. States can make that decision. They could say legal permanent residents of the state can vote. They could say all residents of the state can vote. Nothing in the Constitution says you have to be 18. It says you just can't be taken away from you unless you're at least 18. Things like that. So I think they really need to get aggressive and lean into that identity as the kind of pro-democracy party, or it's going to be hopeless. And again, you have to win by 8. So let's start thinking of some creative ways to get to 8.
Right. But what about the idea that the state of California subsidizes the state of Mississippi? In other words, the Republicans, in their spiteful way, in this so-called middle-class tax cut that they passed, which was a giveaway to the rich, they punished California by taking away the tax deduction for state and local taxes, which is really hitting California hard. And hopefully it'll translate by having these Republican House members kicked out of office. And that will go a long way to changing the House. But still, that shows you the spiteful nature of the Republicans. Is there any way for the state of California, for example, to basically stop subsidizing Mississippi?
Well, it's very difficult, right? And this is, as you say, this is the great irony of American politics, is that the net payers of taxes are places like California, New York, Massachusetts, you know, centers of industry, and the net receivers of taxes typically are, you know, the very small sort of, you know, less industrial states like, you know, Wyoming and Mississippi that are the beneficiaries of the Electoral College. And so it's a very difficult problem because, I mean, you could certainly contemplate extreme measures, you know, California refusing to, you know, remit any taxes to the federal government until they had received, you know, sort of more equal representation. But there's no obvious mechanism for it. It is a bit of a radical idea. But I do think that intuitively that has to be correct, that it just doesn't feel fair for the exact people who are most underrepresented in the present government to also then be the greatest net payers of the revenue to support that government. You know, I mean, I'm not an expert on American history, but that sort of mismatch between taxation and representation somehow seems almost bad in a way, and the kind of thing that people could get kind of exercised about. And I think that they should, because, you know, I think small states are great. I live in Indiana. Indiana's a great state, has some great places. But, you know, great centers of industry like Los Angeles and New York and places like, and Dallas, for that matter, you know, they contribute a lot to the country. And it really doesn't make a lot of sense to me that they then wouldn't have at least proportional say in the affairs of government. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, Ian Samuel, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ian Samuel, who's a professor of law at Indiana University's Bloomington Morris School of Law, where he teaches courses on cybersecurity and the federal courts. He's the co-host of First Monday's FM podcast, and he has an article at The Guardian, Rigging the Vote, How the American Right is on the Way to Permanent Minority Rule. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.